Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. I want to take you back about 50 years to a study that researchers at the University of California, Berkeley were doing on creativity. And essentially what they did was invite the most creative people they could think of to come visit UC Berkeley and get tested. So we're talking writers like Norman Mailer and Truman Capote, and poets like Marianne Moore and William Carlos Williams. And these luminaries start arriving on the Berkeley campus. And when they got there, they took a bunch of tests and they answered questions about how they thought about themselves. And researchers would watch them when they were taking the test, but then also when they were chatting with friends and just socializing. What they were trying to figure out was, what drives these people? What's their process? And what makes some people productive and out-of-the-box thinkers who are willing to stick with a project for a long time where most of us wouldn't? Truman Capote admitted that he did not think creativity was something you could distill.
I think journalism can be taught, but I don't think creative writing can be taught because the only thing that happens is that in a creative writing class, at least the student has a captive audience, which is the other students, to submit his work to or the professor, and he gives him some encouragement in his work. But I don't. I think it's impossible to instill any creative process, whether it's writing or music or painting, in a person who isn't naturally creative. Mm-hmm. We can learn a certain technique, but that's all.
Scott Barry Kaufman and Carolyn Gregoire have looked at this issue of creativity and at the research that has piled up on it ever since the Berkeley study. They collaborated on a new book, Wired to Create. Scott's based at the University of Pennsylvania. Carolyn's a senior writer at the Huffington Post. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Scott, let's start with that Berkeley study. What do you learn by taking a whole bunch of creative people and then putting them under the microscope?
You see lots of paradoxes. Over and over again, you see contradictions. You see a very interesting finding where they found with the creative writers in their sample that they scored really sky high on a lot of measures of mental well-being. What here Barron referred to as ego resiliency, your ability to really be resilient in the face of setbacks.
And Barron was the guy doing the study, right?
That's right. Frank X. Barron is his name. But he also found that they scored sky high in almost every measure of mental illness that he threw at them. So that you don't often see that in the general population. Usually there's kind of this seesaw that you're either flourishing and having well-being or you're languishing and having, suffering from mental illness. But these creative people really went outside the mold, not only in their creative work, but also in their personalities.
Give me a better sense of where intelligence factors in here and sort of what bearing it had on how creative people were. I mean, you know, with Truman Capote and William Carlos Williams, are these brilliant people in terms of actual, you know, like IQ scores?
Right. So if we view brilliance as your score in an IQ test, they were above average. The average sample size, we're not talking about people who are intellectually disabled, but about 120 IQ sort of level, which is high, but not like off the charts high. What Barron found is that while they were above average in intelligence as traditionally measured, that wasn't the special sauce of creativity. That wasn't the creative spark. And he needed to look beyond for further explanations.
Well, one of the secret ingredients that the Berkeley study did find was messiness. And that may not mean a messy desk particularly, but the process of creating great works was pretty messy.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And we especially see this, for instance, in Picasso's paintings. When he was creating the Guernica, which is, you know, a huge work, he created a series of dozens of sketches, and they actually didn't have any sort of linear progress to creating the end product. He would make a sketch of one of the figures and then discard it and then come back to the first sketch. And there was just, for the amount of takes he did for each figure, there seemed to be no logical step-by-step process. It seemed more like blind experimentation. And yet this was late in his career when he, you would think would have had his process down. But the creative process itself is just very messy.
Scott, is the sort of formula for creativity in the sciences different from what it is for writers and for musicians and for artists?
Well, first of all, the messiness of the creative process means that there is no formula. And anyone, like, if people approach a creative problem thinking there's a formula, they're probably going to be less likely to have a creative outcome. But there does seem to be certain characteristics that that add to the unique flavor of artistic creativity versus scientific creativity. Artistic creativity seems to be tied more to an openness, a form of openness to experience, that is openness to beauty, openness to the search for meaning. A lot of artists have this very high drive to find meaning in the objective physical world, and that's why creativity for artists is this great interaction between the self and world. The creativity for them lies in that beautiful space between the two. But then for scientific creativity, you find that they're also searching for the truth, but they're looking for underlying principles and intellectual curiosity, a different kind of openness to experience. An openness to ideas and hypotheses tends to be more important predictor of scientific creativity. But what unites both artistic and scientific creativity is an overall openness to experience.
When you think about some of the secret skills in the arsenals of these outside-the-box thinkers, there's messiness, which we talked about, but daydreaming and solitude are also crucial. How do we know that daydreaming and being alone are so important?
Well, there's different levels we can find that out. One, you look at some of the greatest inventions of all time, and the way the inventors described their process was not through deliberate thinking. They did a lot of deliberate thinking, don't get me wrong, but the moment of insight tends to come when our mind is away from the problem, or our mind is wandering, or another way of putting it is our attention is reduced, that we kind of have like a looseness of associations that can only come about when we're in that kind of state. By the way, having one or two glasses of wine can also get you in that state. There are lots of things that can get you in that state that can be very conducive for idea generation. So looking through, you know, history, but also looking at studies, and there's emerging studies showing that even recreating it in the laboratory, you give people, it's that incubation period. It's that period between having people work intensely on a problem and then having their mind, their attention reduced and working on some other task, and then returning to the task again, and they have much better insights than if they're just working straight through. So there's laboratory studies as well as listening to to the vignettes.
Do you think it can be painful to be a creative person? I mean, you're on the outside, you're thinking differently from the way everybody else is thinking.
So, I mean, let me say that in general, it's painful to be alive, but it's also joyful to be alive. I mean, the Buddhists had this great thing that, you know, none of us gets out without 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. So I think that what creativity allows people to do, all of us, is to channel that suffering into a way that allows us to make greater meaning of our experiences that can lead to what we talk about in the book called post-traumatic growth, which is an emerging field. So I would just frame it a little bit differently. But you do make a good point that being on the outside can be painful, just in the sense that the need for belonging is a really core part of what makes us human. But the need for uniqueness is also something that makes us human. And creative people tend to be more okay than others in being what Paul Torrens called being a minority of one. And he meant by that is being comfortable being the only one in the room that has an idea that no one agrees with. Creative people actually tend to be more comfortable than other people being that minority of one.
When you think about applying all the research that you've looked at, Carolyn, do you feel like we're doing better now at setting up schools and workplaces for creativity?
It's a difficult question. I think in some ways it's become much harder to be creative because we have so many distractions and because our lives are so saturated with technology, and it can easily keep us sort of on a surface level of thought because our attention is constantly being pulled away from what we're doing. And, you know, Eric Barker has this great quote that he says, you know, while everyone else is kind of tweeting and emailing and just trying to keep up with these incessant streams of information, the people who can sit down and focus on a task for hours are the ones who will rule the world. And I think that's so true. And
it's hard to do. It's really hard to sit down for hours without, like, you know, checking to see if you got texts. That's pretty important. That's pretty big deal.
It's really hard to do. Yeah, and our lifestyles and our workplaces often don't support that.
Right, exactly. So, Scott, big question, and you must think about this a lot since you're at a university. Can you teach creativity? Is that something you can impart to other people?
I get that question a lot. creativity, having a set curriculum is probably not the way to go about it if you want to improve creativity. You know, when we talk about in this book, we talk about these habits that anyone can adopt. You can choose tomorrow to wake up and be more open to new experiences, to go towards things you're fearful in, the idea that you're going to have, you could have post-traumatic growth from those experiences, that you can daydream, that it's okay to daydream, you know, that it's okay to, you know, be mindful as well of your surroundings, et cetera, et cetera. So in the one sense, we would argue that creativity can be improved. And then you asked, can it be taught? You know, and I think that when we're scaling it to down, you know, to an education environment, to that sort of unique microcosm, you can allow creativity to increase among students by letting them increase their self-expression, giving them autonomy, giving them a sense of competence and mastery in what they're learning, that they're proud of what they're doing because it's something they're deeply passionate about. So do you see what I'm saying? I wouldn't want to teach it in a standardized way. That is like, that gets besides the point.
But it can be nurtured. I think maybe Nurtured is a better word than teach, in the sense
that
it's pulling.
I like that.
It's pulling out something that's to some extent already there.
Carolyn, there are whole scholarly journals now that think about this idea of creativity and how to study it and how to attain it. Do you worry that we've become slightly obsessed with the word, with this notion of attaining creativity?
Yeah, I think it is something of an obsession, that's for sure. But interestingly, I think while it's something that we say is so important to us, you know, that's more in theory than in practice. A lot of companies, for instance, say that innovation is important to them and that they want their workers to be creative. But then when people come up with creative ideas, they're not actually supported. And so I think embracing failure needs to be part of the equation. If we're going to be obsessed with creativity the way that we are, we need to see the whole picture of creativity, which isn't always, you know, a beautiful piece of art, and it's not always perfect. And it does involve a lot of failure and a lot of bad ideas.
It's something we say we want, but when you're a manager or a teacher and you have someone who's like, I completely disagree with everything this organization is doing, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, we're like, you know, let's fire this person. We don't say, oh, let's listen to this person. Maybe we're actually wrong. You know, maybe this person does have a really creative idea here. You know, a lot of companies say they like creativity, but they're also very, very scared of change, right? So you see these paradoxes within, mm-hmm. you know, organizations all the time.
And not just companies, but research has shown that Nobel Prize winners, like these huge paradigm shifting scientific discoveries, are routinely rejected from scientific journals. And I think it's because we are afraid of things that shift the paradigm. And we are often afraid to move things forward and to see where the existing framework is a little cracked. And so, you know, that's certainly not an easy thing for us to do, but creativity really requires that we see things in a very different way, which is why it's both appealing to us and also scary.
Carolyn Gregoire is a senior writer at the Huffington Post. Scott Kaufman is the scientific director of the Imagination Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. They are authors of the new book, Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Come with me and you'll be